From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On this week's show, KC police unveil a new strategy to combat crime.
They're not afraid of the police. They're not afraid of going to jail. Going to prison may be considered part of doing business.
Mayor Sly James proposes a way to finally pay for street repairs and park maintenance. Plus, hear how some inmates are staying connected with their families.
Sugar, I want to let you know how much I love you and miss you. I just miss you so much, and I hope that you go back and reread your books and reread your CDs and stuff.
And learn about the history of Kansas City's champion cakewalker.
Even during times of severe oppression, a black cultural expression becomes important in terms of how we are able to express rebellion.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news.
I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We take you to neighborhoods around the region using voices, stories, and sound.
What will it take for Kansas City, Missouri to finally fix its streets and sewer system? Earlier this year, Mayor Sly James announced a bold plan for improving the city's infrastructure that would involve spending $1 billion over the next 10 years. He scaled back that plan a bit since then, and his most recent proposal goes before the council this week, and if approved, to voters. It's already been endorsed by the Finance and Infrastructure Committee. To get details on how the new plan would affect the taxes of Kansas City residents, I caught up with KCUR's own Steve Bell, who follows City Hall closely. Thanks for hopping over to KC Currents this week, Steve.
Not a problem. I always enjoy it.
So what's the need here in Kansas City in terms of infrastructure?
Needs are big. The city has been through tough times, and even before the tough times, was putting a lot of things on the back burner, and that deferred maintenance list has gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. Then comes the recession and budget cuts. We have parkland in Kansas City where the weeds grew 5-6 feet tall and stayed that way for months at a time last year along walking trails. We have parks that we're not getting mowed regularly. We have broken things in the parks. The community centers are in trouble. We're doing better with streets, but still, streets need a lot of work. And on top of it, the federal government says we have to rebuild our stormwater and sewer system.
And it's something every mayor and candidate has talked about.
Absolutely.
Now, Mayor Sly James had this big, ambitious idea to spend $1 billion on infrastructure. How did the council react to that idea?
Actually, people told him they needed it, but they didn't think it would ever pass the voters at this time, particularly in view of the fact that we have this other sewer thing coming up, and in addition to whatever is needed on other infrastructure.
So he ended up scaling back. And first of all, he's proposing ending some taxes, right?
Yeah. He wants to end the $12.50 vehicle city tax, which we used to call the city sticker. He wants to get rid of some what some people call nuisance taxes that had to do with real estate property and real estate property along boulevards and things of that nature.
And what's the new tax that would replace those taxes?
He wants to then increase the city's sales tax by 0.5 cents per dollar and dedicate that money specifically to parks and community centers.
And would that end up being about the same amount?
It would end up being more. And that's the interesting thing about the proposal. If you listen to Mayor James sell it, he does a good sales pitch. And what he says is, we're going to get a lot more money. We're going to be able to do, again, what we need to do in the parks. We're going to be able to do more with the streets. And it's not going to cost the average resident very much. He says maybe nothing, maybe no increase in cost, but he says he won't promise that. But he will promise that it could cost the average resident $10-$15 a year to kick another huge batch of money, something like $15-$20 million a year, into what the city has to spend.
And as you pointed out earlier this week, that sales tax will depend on how the economy is, how much it brings in.
Yeah, and he makes that point. He says that puts the parks in a situation where basically, it will double what they had to spend last year if it works anything like we think it will. And it's a thing where if the economy goes bad, it goes down. If the economy gets better, it goes up. It makes it a flexible thing.
And the next part of Mayor James' most recent plan would call for a bond issue, and that's for sewers.
The federal government, the Environmental Protection Agency, has dictated that Kansas City must do this. It says you got to stop flooding places that shouldn't be flooded, and at that, not only flooding them, but flooding them with raw sewage.
Yeah. And before the proposal, how is the city going to pay for this huge overhaul of the sewer system?
Before proposing the bond issue, the only thing that the city could have done to meet the federal deadlines on this stuff is to raise the water and sewer bills, maybe as much as $25 a month. And what the city manager is saying is if we issue $500 million worth of bonds toward a multi-billion-dollar project, A, we can get started, we can take advantage of good interest rates, we can take advantage of good labor rates, we can meet the deadlines and avoid the fines, and although we do have to pay the interest on the bonds and pay them off eventually, it will end up costing the average citizen less, much less, than if we rolled it over into the sewer and water bills.
Now, on Thursday morning, Mayor James went before a council committee and they passed the plan. Was there a lot of discussion?
There was a lot of discussion. There was a lot of focus on wording. There was a lot of focus on what they could say about the cost and whether they should say that the bond issue did not involve the tax increase, which it doesn't. And finally, they came up with a plan, which I'm sure will be fine-tuned over the next week, but the committee endorsed it, and they said, look, we need this. Our streets are not in good shape. Our parks are a mess. Our community centers are not getting the attention they need, and we have a chance to do something about that. So let's refine it and put it on the ballot in August. Now, that's what the committee said. It has to go to the full council, which it will do this coming Thursday.
Any idea whether the full council will pass it?
I think it will. Now we could get a surprise. I've given up on predicting what legislative bodies will do, but if I were a predicting man, I would predict that they will pass it.
So what has all this shown about Mayor Sly James' leadership?
Sly James brings a unique and effective style of leadership that we haven't seen since I've been at KCUR. Certainly didn't see in the last administration. He is better at forging relationships and getting support from council members than anybody in recent memory in that office. Some of the things, some of the ways he does things, well, he doesn't want to be interfered with. He has changed the rules at City Hall. There's much less opportunity for public arguments among the council members and himself. The way that things are done, I don't want to say things are railroaded through, but he certainly expedites things through in an aggressive manner. And we're about to see another example of that with the vote on the streetcar district downtown, which is a unique approach to that. Having only people in one area of town vote on it and only people who live there. And it'll be interesting to see how that comes out, because I read today that only a few hundred people have contacted City Hall to ask for ballots. I wonder which they are. Are they folks that are with him or the folks that are against him?
Interesting. And we'll talk more about that in upcoming weeks. But Steve Bell, thank you so much for joining us on KC Currents.
Thank you. I love it.
Kansas City has tried many programs to reduce violent crime, but despite them all, the first 5 months of 2012 have seen more violent crime than in many recent years. A new program focused on the social networks of violent criminals aims to change that. It's called KC NOVA, short for the No Violence Alliance. Participating agencies include the Jackson County Prosecutor's Office, the KCPD, the Mayor's Office, and the U.S. Attorney for the Western District of Missouri. UMKC's Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology is also pitching in. They're supplying background data and helping to identify local trends. To learn more about KC Nova, Susan spoke with UMKC Criminal Justice Professor Dr. Ken Novak.
KC Nova, the idea came up through looking at what has been done in best practices in other cities. The approach that's going to be used here is similar to, but not exactly to, approaches in Boston and Chicago and Cincinnati and High Point and Stockton and Indianapolis. And so the approach that's going to be used is recognizing that focusing attention on the chronic offenders and their social network can have reductions in violent crime.
Well, you know, there have been a number of anti-violence initiatives in Kansas City. Of course, there's Aim for Peace. There's been reports. What makes this particular initiative different from the others?
I think that this may complement some of the other initiatives, but one unique aspect of this is that it's going to be implemented in a very strategic way and using multiple agencies, all working in concert with each other. Very often, the different agencies, all of whom are interested in crime prevention and crime control, are operating in silos. And so what KC Nova will be able to do is use information that is gathered by all the different agencies and try to strategically align resources where they're most going to be most effective and efficient.
Now, you mentioned that this plan worked in other cities, for example, Boston and Cincinnati. What's going to be different about what we try here from those other cities so far?
The strategy may be a little bit different because the crime problems are different in every city. You can't assume necessarily that the violent problem in Boston is the exact same thing that's going on in Kansas City. So the first step that all of those cities did was carefully analyze exactly what is going on in their particular city. In Boston, it was youth gangs. In Cincinnati, it was groups of people who were socially connected but not really affiliated with gangs. They anticipated in some cities that the problem would be youth, you know, 17 to 22 years old. In other cities, they found that the people who were most prone to violence and most prone to being victimized by violence was more age 24 to 29. And so the difference in Kansas City is going to be each city needs to take a very honest look at what the underlying root causes of their violent crime problem is, and make a approach that is tailored to those particular problems.
Now, do you have any ideas now, knowing what you do about Kansas City, what are some likely issues or approaches that would be unique to Kansas City?
Well, what I know about Kansas City and what I'm going to assume based on what we've seen elsewhere is that violence is going to be concentrated among smaller groups of people. That's true. To find anything different would be contrary to 80 to 100 years of criminology. I also believe that crime is concentrated in certain geographic areas, and we have the data to demonstrate that. But as far as what we're going to find in Kansas City, it's going to be very interesting to determine to what extent it's gang-related or just loose groups of people who hang together but really wouldn't be considered a gang in the traditional sense. Some cities, Boston, Chicago, L.A., have very well-defined, coherent, organized gangs. I think that's maybe a little bit less of the issue in Kansas City, but going in with an open mind to understand that that may be part of, but not the sole problem or root cause of violence is going to be important.
Now, I want to go back to something you said. You mentioned that one centerpiece of this initiative is going to be to try to understand how social networks play a role in crime prevention. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, the idea of social networks is that many people who are prone to violence or likely to commit violence are going to have a hard time being deterred from traditional criminal sanction. They're not afraid of the police. They're not afraid of going to jail. Going to prison may be considered part of doing business. It's just a very different way that most people don't realize the pleasure versus pain principle doesn't always apply to everyone. Crime is a function of opportunity. More pressure may be placed on people to comply and be pro-social from their peers rather than the formal criminal justice system. So what the role of the social networking will do is to identify not just those people who are crime-prone, but who they hang with, and make sure that those groups of people recognize that if anybody in their group gets involved with violence, then the full weight of the criminal justice system will come down not just on them, but on their social network. And so what they found in other cities is that the social pressure from peers to not commit crime actually is much more effective than the threat of criminal action by the police or the prosecutor's office.
That's really interesting. But I think even though this notion of social networking is very powerful, actually doing it is kind of difficult. How so?
It's very difficult because gathering the right information and complete information is very difficult. And getting two people to communicate this message may be rather complicated. People who are on probation, people who are on parole, they'll be very easy to identify, locate, and get a hold of to communicate this type of message because it could be part of their term of release. But if part of the social network is not currently under supervision, finding, identifying these people may be a little bit more complicated because records are incomplete of where they live exactly.
Now, I know one other aspect of this program is that it attempts to make leading a criminal effort less attractive to, let's say, the underlings in a gang or some other loosely organized criminal outfit. How is this going to work?
Well, within the social network, there may be people who clearly have a lot of experience with the criminal justice system. They've been arrested, they may have been in jail, they've been charged with crimes, very serious crimes. But then other people within their network are very likely at the beginning phases of their age crime curve. They may have small incidents with the police, maybe some truancy, some school issues, but not really any violent records in their background that would bring them to the attention of the police. But there are going to be cousins and brothers and girlfriends and whatnot of people who all hang together. Trying to identify the people who may be having all the risk factors associated with being involved with violence and getting to them to make sure that they are aware of and can take advantage of social services is also a critical component of this. One of the things that this program is not designed to do is it's not designed to just be a zero tolerance, lock up more people type of approach. In some cities, Cincinnati as an example, by strategically identifying those who, quote, need to go to jail, as well as identifying those who would be more amenable towards social services, they actually saw their total jail population for violent crimes decline at the same time that the violence on the streets declined. So it's not just doing more and using more resources, it's using those resources, both in terms of the police, prosecution, and jails, more wisely.
Now, you mentioned social services a couple of times. What kind of social services are used in this kind of a project?
Social services such as job training, making sure people are connected with employers and or have access to job training, making sure people have access to continuing education, GEDs if necessary, making sure people have access to anger management or other types of domestic services to help them be more pro-social. There's a variety of different agencies, hidden allies, that may be able to offer these types of services to people who may be not currently being tapped as much as they are currently being done so.
The economy is bad right now. The unemployment rate for young African American men is double the average population. and black men have been underemployed for years, and it doesn't look, and Hispanic men, and it doesn't look like this is going to be something easily solvable. There aren't jobs out there, and to my knowledge, there's not sufficient job training in terms of really training for jobs that exist that will give people a living wage that is more than working for McDonald's, which most people aren't going to want to do. So is this a realistic approach unless something different happens with job options and job training?
I think job training and job options and the full employment in general is clearly a piece of the puzzle. Those are things that may be beyond the control of the working group, but not beyond the scope, in that they need to be, and they need to be concerned with that as much as anyone else is. This may be an opportunity to identify not only those who are underserved, but be a catalyst for agencies or new agencies to provide additional services like this. One of the problems with having a city that has a lot of violent crime is that it does have an indirect impact on the local economy. It's very difficult to have corporations and industry invest heavily in areas where there's a lot of crime. If Kansas City has a higher crime rate than other cities, corporations may be less likely to invest economically in the Kansas City, and the cycle continues. And so getting a handle on the violent crime problem may be a precursor to larger economic development within the city and the region.
Well, Ken Novak, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
Thank you very much.
Ken Novak is chair of the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at UMKC.
Coming up, a program helps prisoners keep in touch with their kids. You're listening to KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
In Missouri state prisons, about 60% of inmates have kids. That's 18,000 moms and dads behind bars, and tens of thousands of kids on the other side. From Station KBIA in Columbia, Jacob Fenston brings us the story of one program aimed at helping those parents and kids connect.
Here we go. You ready for this adventure? All righty. Page one.
Calione Barnes is sitting down to read a picture book to his 7-year-old daughter.
She liked Dora, you know, Dora and SpongeBob, you know, the typical 7-year-old stuff.
Today's book is about lions and tigers.
Roar! Lion cubs spend lots of time chasing and pouncing on each other. This is how they learn to defend themselves and hunt. Once they are grown, males leave their sisters and mother behind to form their own pride.
But Barnes isn't sitting in a comfy chair at home.
Next page.
His daughter isn't curled up next to him.
Now, this is a different cat.
He's in prison, in front of a CD recorder.
This is called a tiger.
One Saturday morning each month, volunteers make their way through the metal detectors here at Tipton Correctional Center with big tubs of blank tapes and CDs, stamped envelopes, and lots of books.
We've collected thousands and thousands of books. We probably have 10 or 20,000 books in a storage unit we keep in St. Louis.
Jane Obenshine, she and her husband,
Dana Obenshine.
They've been doing this since 1998, starting at a women's prison.
Seeing the moms with their kids really broke our hearts because a lot of the kids and the moms didn't know each other at all.
Their idea is that a book and a parent's voice can help bridge that gap of distance and barbed wire. These days, the Obenshines and other volunteers visit 15 state prisons each month. Inmates choose a book,
Wildcats,
read it to the recorder, then mail it off across the state.
Sugar, I want to let you know how much I love you and miss you. I just miss you so much, and I hope that you go back and reread your books and reread your CDs and stuff. You have a blessed day, and Daddy loves you. Bye.
There it is.
A few days later, 160 miles away in St. Louis County. What's the book?
Wildcats.
I'm putting her CD in that her dad gave her, the Wildcat, so he can read the book while she's turning the pages.
Here we go. You ready for this adventure? All right.
It helps her a lot because she'll try to sound out the words and then she'll listen and listen and listen till she learn all the words in the book from him reading it to her.
Take a nap under a tree or
rolling
in the grass.
Dontavia Barnes has actually never known her dad outside of prison. She was born a few months after he was incarcerated.
From the moment she was born, I saw her like one time, she was like 2 weeks old, and I didn't see her up until 2010 and she was five. Her guardian contacted me.
I'm LaVonda Evans.
That's who had her, that's who raised her, that's who changed her diaper.
I've been aware ever since she's been a baby. When she first walked, when she first talked, when she lost her first teeth.
And so then how did you get back in touch with her biological father?
I actually met one of his aunts at her doctor's office, and she gave me his name, and I just wrote the prison.
And was like, look, you know, I have your daughter, and I want you to meet her. And, you know, I just wept.
When he wrote back and we found out where he was, I took her to see him within the first 2 weeks.
The first day I went to go see him. With my mom and my brothers.
It was just a happy day.
It was fun.
It was real great. Because I think every child should know their parents.
And was there a time when you sort of had to explain to her your dad is in prison and what that means?
I had to tell her that on our first visit on the way down. So she understands it to a certain point. Then to a certain point, she does it.
I don't lie to her. She asked me, what did you do? And I told her, Daddy was stupid and selfish and childish.
It was back in 2004. A drug deal turned into a robbery.
And in the course of the robbery, it went haywire.
He was with a friend. The friend had a gun, and the guy they were robbing ended up dead.
Even when there are sort of disturbing violent crimes, those individuals return to the communities and they return to their families. They become parents again.
Clark Peters is a professor at the University of Missouri. He says programs that help parents in prison connect with their kids can make a big difference later on.
If they've been completely absent and there's been no maintenance of that connection, that'll just make for a much more troublesome reentry process.
What's the book you chose there?
It's called Windows of Nature, Animals of the Woodlands.
My name is Shredda Collins. I'm here at Chillicothe Correctional Institute. I've been incarcerated for almost 2 years now.
Here at the women's prison in Chillicothe, 80% of the inmates have kids. Soretta Collins has a 4-year-old daughter.
Hi, Kayla. This is Mommy. I'm going to read you Windows of the Nature, Animals in the
Woodlands. I guess you can't really explain it to a 4-year-old. The best way I've put it is, you know, Mommy's in big girl timeout, you know, and she knows what timeout is, so she understands that.
Here are just a few of the woodland animals found in America and Europe. 1, woodpeckers.
I'm a meth addict, and my drugs, I didn't see it then in that light. You know, I thought because I was home every night to put her to bed that I wasn't harming her.
4, badgers.
I know I'm always going to be mom. I may not be in her eyes right now, but hopefully I can work back into that relationship. You know, these last 2.5 years, I've lost it. You know, I saw her first tooth. I saw her first walks. You know, I was there for her first words, but I'm hoping she'll take me back.
Kayla, I really hope you enjoy this book, and I hope you learned some things, because I know I did. I love you, baby, and I'll talk to you soon. Love you. Bye.
About 1 month after I met Calione Barnes at the state prison in Tipton, we met up again.
We was at St. Louis Zoo, and I got out. I got released from prison Monday, around 9 o'clock Monday morning.
It's Wednesday, 2 days after he got released, and he's waiting outside the zoo to meet his daughter, Dontavia.
What's up, sugar?
It's the first time they've ever seen each other outside of prison.
Where my hug at? Wait, nothing.
How you out?
How I get out? I got out to come see you, so I can be with you.
And did they take you back?
No, I don't have to go back.
You gotta go back.
No, I'm out, I'm free. I come to have fun with you at the zoo.
Okay.
If this were a movie, you would. This is when the sort of you would cue the music, and there would be triumph, right?
Beautiful time, having an awesome time. What about you? Are you having fun?
Y-E-S.
Well, that's not when the story ends. That's when, for really, the story begins, and it's a different tune within a couple of days, often, and it's a very difficult process.
But Barnes says, at age 38, after almost 8 years in prison, he's ready for that challenge.
The cycle has to stop. The generational curse has to stop, okay? My mom got killed when I was 12, and my dad got killed when I was 13. I always said that my children wouldn't grow up like me, but yet I was doing the exact same thing that my parents did. My mind is right. I'm not using drugs today, okay? I can be a father today.
Here we go.
Here we go.
From the Health and Wealth Desk, I'm Jacob Fenster.
Super fast.
If you can't listen to all of Casey Kearns today, catch what you missed online in our audio archives. And we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes. Who is the farmer of the future? That's the question being posed by Harvest Public Media this week in a series airing on Morning Edition. The stories will explore how demographic, technological, and cultural forces will shape America's food producers into the next decade and beyond.
On Casey Kearns today, we kick off the series with a story from Kathleen Masterson. She reports that while much of the rural Midwest is hollowing out, some regions are actually growing. That's largely due to immigrant populations taking ag-related jobs that otherwise employers can't fill. Melding cultures is never easy, but in communities like Sioux County, Iowa, members of the Latino community are slowly changing the landscape of the rural Midwest.
This corner of Northwest Iowa is known for its Dutch pastries. The landscape is dotted with Lutheran and Reformed churches. But now Catholic churches and tortillerias are creeping into the landscape, signs of the new residents joining this vibrant community. Terry Van Manen runs Winding Meadows Dairy in Sioux County, Iowa. He bought the family farm from his father in the 80s. His farm itself is indicative of how much the region has changed in the last few decades.
How are you? Is this the end of the shift?
No speaking.
Check your Spanish out talking to Martin.
The workers are cleaning out the milking parlor before bringing in the next batch of cows. Van Manen explains the 600-cow operation runs 24 hours a day, every day of the week, even on Christmas.
I mean, you get people apply for a job here. Oh, weekends and nights? Oh, no, not interested.
Van Manen says about two-thirds of his workers are Latino.
I honestly think I could not run my business if all these the guys that are working for me were to leave and I had to fill them with non-Hispanic help, I think I'd have to close the door. It would be tough.
Some of Van Manen's staff, Anglo and Latino, have been with him over 10 years. He says everyone gets along well in the workplace, even though not all employees speak English. But when it comes to mixing outside of work, Van Manen says the Anglo and Latino cultures have been slower to socialize.
The schools, I think, kind of brings everybody together. You know, when their families have kids that go to the community school, I think it gives us a common entity to circle around.
Latino children make up about 20% of the classrooms in Sioux Center and nearby towns. Overall, the town's population has grown 17%, and the county is up 7% over the last decade. Meanwhile, most of rural Iowa is losing people. 91 of Iowa's 99 counties have declined by about 9% over the last three decades. So it's not just about labor. If Sioux County is any indication, for some Midwestern communities, immigrant populations could be an important part of keeping rural culture alive. Back in the milking parlor at Winding Meadows Dairy, there's the whirring of giant pumps moving milk out to the stainless steel tank. Luis Campos, the parlor manager, says he came to the U.S. illegally. But he married a U.S. citizen and got his papers. Still, it took him a while to adjust to Iowa.
First, yeah, it's too hard for me, especially when I was single. But now I got kids. My kids now, they like here. They born here, you know, in America. The schools in here is better. You know, everything is better here.
When I asked him if he felt comfortable in the culture, Campo says he now considers himself.
I am most, maybe half and half, you know, half mine and half like you guys, you know.
As far as community involvement, Campos is really involved, but mostly in the Latino community. He leads the Mexican Totonaca dancing at the local Catholic church and teaches Sunday school to kindergartners. Enrique Lovano also really likes living in Iowa. Originally from Mexico, he's lived here for 15 years now, and he's worked his way up to a supervisor position at the pork processing plant, Natural Food Holdings. He says Latino and Anglo cultures are still fairly separate.
We respect each other. That's what is nice about here. You know, you don't hear about people fighting because of the color of their skin. Here, it's just everybody mind their own business and away we go.
Lovano is now a legal resident, but many others live in constant fear, community advocates say. They've established families and lives here, but if they're pulled over coming back from the grocery store, they could be deported within days. Still, there are signs Latinos are making a home here. There are bilingual churches, local volunteers teach English night classes, law enforcement has had training on working in a diverse community. And these new residents are an important part of the community and its future, says Gary Malenki, the president of Natural Food Holdings Pork Processing Plant.
Misconception, I think, that people have is that I think people believe that, oh, these immigrants are stealing all these jobs. We don't see that here, okay? I mean, we just don't.
Malenki says there's a real need for laborers in dairies, hog confinements, poultry farms, and general construction, too. Not only are immigrants helping buoy the farm economy, but their children are American citizens. They're part of church communities and schools and sports teams.
There's a lot of progress in these communities. In Sioux Center, they're going to build a hospital, a $48 million hospital. Not just a hospital. And that's the kind of things that are happening in these communities, which, face it, that tells you that businesses are doing well.
And when communities do well, it gives everybody options. The kids of these immigrant workers, just like other rural kids in the Midwest, are not all going into farm work. Some want to be doctors, teachers, and business owners. And just like generations before, because of their parents' hard work, they'll have that opportunity. I'm Kathleen Masterson, Harvest Public Media.
For more stories, videos, and slideshows from Harvest Public Media's Farmer of the Future project, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. And don't miss the accompanying documentary, Hispanic Farmers on Broken Ground, which will air on KCPT Channel 19 at 8 p.m. this Friday.
For the past quarter century, one person has been a constant at KCUR, General Manager Patty Cahill. That's going to change later this summer when she retires. Her replacement will be Nico Leone. He served for the past 5 years as co-executive director of KDHX, a community radio station in St. Louis. In that role, he's been the public face of the station, which is primarily a music station, focusing on fundraising, marketing, programming, and community outreach. KCUR's Maria Carter caught up with him over the phone just after the announcement was made.
Nico, congratulations and welcome to your new job at KCUR.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here.
And Nico, what was your reaction when you found out you were picked as the new general manager here?
Well, first, excitement. I think it's a great station. There's good people. You do spectacular work both locally, regionally, and nationally, and I'm really honored to come on board and to have the opportunity to work with the staff and to explore ways that we can even better serve the Kansas City region.
And tell us a little bit about your background and how you got involved in radio.
I actually got involved in high school. I was living in a small town in Kansas. I've got some good roots just outside of Kansas City. I grew up in a town called Lacine, about an hour south of Kansas City, just inside the Missouri border, and then went to high school in Emporia. And a family friend owned a small station, and on evenings, weekends, I'd go in and hang out at the station, ran the board for a little while. When I went to college down in Waco, Texas, I worked at a student station for 3 or 4 years while I was there. So I've got some long background. Graduated from college, and it was one of those things where I thought I'd never have a job in the real world that I loved as much as the one I had in college, because public radio jobs are great and hard to get. And after moving up to St. Louis, got connected with KDHX. I've been here for about 8 years in a variety of different roles, the last 5 as co-executive director, which is a little bit different leadership model, but it's been a great place for me to kind of learn and grow as a manager.
You mentioned your background growing up in Kansas. How are you going to get to know the Kansas City area and KCUR?
I think one of the most exciting things is that process of getting to know a community, whether it's the station itself or the broader Kansas City community. I've been familiar from a distance for a while, and I'm really looking forward to digging in. From a distance, it certainly seems like there's been a really strong renaissance of arts and culture over the last 5 to 10 years in Kansas City. There's a lot of great things happening through downtown in kind of the Power and Light District and the Crossroads Arts District. And I'm really interested in exploring those things and understanding how KCUR fits in that larger picture of what's going on in Kansas City. I think there'll be a lot of time that I need to spend out in the community. There'll be a lot of time I need to spend digging in with KCUR staff and really understanding their strengths on a really granular level, and then understanding what everybody's vision is for the future of KCUR and how it can really be a powerful, impactful local institution based in the great news and journalism that it provides to the region.
What are some of those things that you've accomplished there at KDHX that you'd like to bring to KCUR?
I think as much as anything else, what I'd like to bring is a little bit different perspective towards community engagement, towards philanthropy, and a more philanthropic approach to fundraising. We've had a really great staff and a great group of volunteers here at KDHX that have been able to do some really great work as we've plugged into the community. We've been able to launch the first capital campaign at KDHX and have started construction on a new building in the heart of the Arts and Entertainment District of St. Louis. We've been able to engage a lot of the major arts and cultural institutions in St. Louis in a way that we really hadn't in the past. And really, I think we connect to the community in a very different way than we did even 5 years ago. And while I don't have a lot of very specific plans for the details of how those things will happen at KCUR, I'm excited to figure those out alongside the staff there.
One thing that came up in our staff discussions as we were looking for a new general manager is the digital future and how KCUR moves into that digital age. How do you see that fitting in to your vision for this station?
I think for radio to really thrive, it has to be more than just radio. And for public radio to survive, even, it has to be more than just public radio. We've got to think of ourselves as media first, and we've got to think of ourselves in terms of how we connect with and interact with the community. So I think it's, not to dodge the question, but it's less about specific ways in which we do that and more about a philosophy of how we do that. We need to be connecting with people beyond just our over-the-air broadcast signal, but via the web, via social media, through the community, and in whatever new and different ways they want to interact with us in the future, because they're certainly not going to be the same next year or 2 years from now that they are now. So I think as much as anything else, it's a philosophy of engaging the community in the manner that the community wants to be engaged with, and for looking for new and innovative ways that are compatible with the strengths of the station and compatible with a news and journalism organization and meeting the community where it is.
That was Nico Leone, who will take over as KCUR General Manager in August.
After the break, hear a piece of music dedicated to Kansas City's champion cakewalker, Doc Brown. This is Casey Currents. This is Casey Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
In area news this week, Missouri lawmakers ended their session by attacking the Democrats. Republican factions stayed deadlocked in the Kansas legislature. And Mayor Sly James pitched a plan to revamp taxes and repair infrastructure. Steve Bell looks back at those and other top stories of the week on the KCUR Weekend News Review.
Sly James's reform and repair tax plan would swap the city car license and some property taxes for a 1/2 cent sales tax increase and use the money for streets, parks, and community centers. James said he thought the voters would buy in on it.
The sales tax, unlike the taxes that we are repealing, are paid by people outside of Kansas City, so the entire burden would not fall on Kansas City.
The tax plan is accompanied by a call for $500 million worth of bonds to finance a federally mandated sewer overhaul. Both measures still require approval from the full council and the voters. The Kansas legislature was still getting attention for what it didn't do. Negotiators came up with a tax-cutting plan designed not to tax the amount of revenue coming in so much as the one on Governor Brownback's desk, and he asked that it be passed.
It's a good bill. I think it'd be better if we would go with this conference report.
But House conservatives were still grousing that the plan wasn't aggressive enough, Senate moderates that it was too aggressive, and the governor said he would sign the bill that did pass that would produce billions in deficits rather than not have a tax cut. There was still no agreement on congressional redistricting, And Secretary of State Chris Kobach and Johnson County leaders joined a lawsuit asking a federal court to take over the process.
The legislature, by failing to do its constitutional duty, has put us in this bind.
Missouri lawmakers got attention for what they did do, inducting Rush Limbaugh into the Hall of Famous Missourians in an invitation-only ceremony. Limbaugh praised House Speaker Stephen Tilley for not giving in to objectors.
He hung in. He was tough. Laughed at them when they called his office, which is what you have to do, because they're deranged.
In its final week, among bills the Missouri Assembly passed, ones allowing land banks, letting health workers and employers refuse to provide services like abortion and birth control, lowering fees for shipping radioactive materials through the state, reducing the disparity between penalties for crack and powder cocaine, and prohibiting the implementation of health insurance exchanges as specified in the Federal Health Care Act at penalty of lawsuit. House Member Ryan Silvey said,
well, as far as I'm concerned, this isn't about the national health care debate. This is about reining in a governor that is out of control.
A bill regarding a state takeover of the Kansas City School District stalled. Area law enforcement began a program called NOVA to reduce violent crime in Kansas City. Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker explained the focus.
It's a small number of people that cause the violent crime in our city. With that knowledge of who those people are, we're going to strategically focus our efforts on them.
A similar program in Boston eventually reduced homicides 63%. Wrapping up the week, lawyers for defrocked priest Sean Rattigan asked that his federal trial on child pornography charges be delayed for 2 months. Overland Park police finally found the body of a man who apparently drowned in Indian Creek after going out to look at its flooding. Johnson County leaders complained that the new computer system that was supposed to improve the Kansas motor vehicle licensing process has been taking twice as long as the old one. And with Tuesday the deadline, only a few hundred voters had requested ballots for the downtown streetcar district election. This is KCUR.
Every month, the staff of the Kansas City Museum asks some kind of expert in the community to talk about a piece from the museum's collection. It's called the Community Curator Program. This month's talk, coming up on Tuesday, is by Glenn North, the poet in residence at the American Jazz Museum. The piece is a painting, one that made North a little uncomfortable, and it's connected to a piece of music from 1899. We'll let Glenn North explain.
I was very excited when I was asked to participate in the Community Curator Program, and I was very interested in discovering an object or something in the Kansas City Museum's collection that would speak to the Black experience. What was made available to me was this huge picture of legendary cakewalker, which is a form of dance, and I'll talk about that in just a bit, but this guy was a champion cakewalker who really made a name for himself here in Kansas City in the 1890s, and there's this picture of him that was done by actually an African-American painter named Miller C. Haywood. It's Doc Brown in a top hat and tails, and he's standing in front of like a red brick wall, and he's kind of posing with his hat, kind of tipping his hat to the viewer in the painting and smiling. Initially, my thoughts were I was uncomfortable in that part of African-American history when we talk about minstrelsy and some of the things that were forced upon Black entertainers during that time for them to have to act, you know, to kind of step and fetch and jive and shuffle. All of those thoughts kind of rushed into my mind. But as I thought more about who this man must have been to have gained enough prominence for this incredible painting to be made in his honor, I figured his story deserved to be told. One of the things that I was really impressed with, I thought initially it would be hard to find information about him. I had never heard of him before, this Doc Brown. But there were tons of articles about Doc Brown several quotes from him about how proud he was of being a champion cakewalker and how no one could beat him and how he didn't want to take on a job that required hard labor because that would mess with the suppleness of his moves. And for the Kansas City Star to do such an, you know, this extensive job of covering his various cakewalk championships, and he was a very public figure and must have been very charismatic. And so he became somebody that I eventually admired. The cakewalk originated on southern plantations, and when slave owners would have social functions, formal social gatherings, they would do the waltz or the minuet. The slaves who saw these kinds of dances did their own take on it and would really be poking fun of the white establishment. It was a parody. But then white people enjoyed seeing the people who had been enslaved doing the dances so much that they turned into these competitions. And on different plantations where they would have one of these dance competitions, the prize for the winning couple would be a cake. So that's where you get the term, you know, she takes the cake. Or sometimes if something is easy or fun, you'll say, oh, that's a cakewalk. Eventually, white people then started wearing blackface, and in minstrel shows, they would then poke fun of how black people danced. And so there's this weird history associated with it. But what I think is the most interesting thing is that even during times of severe oppression, black cultural expression becomes important in terms of how we are able to express rebellion, because it originated as a way to kind of subtly poke fun of the white slave owners. Kansas City became a place where ragtime had become popular, and cakewalks, they preceded ragtime, but cakewalking was becoming more and more popular as ragtime was. And so some of the early compositions were called rags, or they were called cakewalks. And this guy, Charles L. Johnson, was a very highly respected composer here in Kansas City, and he really liked Doc Brown. So he wrote a song called Doc Brown's Cakewalk, and it gained popularity because the legendary band leader John Philip Sousa was actually traveling through Kansas City and really liked that composition and performed it here. And so that really validated the song, and it turned into a huge hit for Charles L. Johnson. But the fact that it was inspired by Doc Brown, I think, is incredible.
Glenn North is poet in residence at the American Jazz Museum. He'll be talking about Doc Brown and cakewalking as part of the Kansas City Museum's Community Curator Series on Tuesday evening at Union Station.
Thanks for tuning in to KC Currents. If you missed anything or you want to hear it all over again, this show will be archived on our KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast. Find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Carrie Coogan is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.